Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders, whoever else that are changing the world of UK healthcare, and not just UK healthcare, but healthcare across the world. As regular listeners will know, and people that interact with the show or look across any of the other platforms, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech company myself called PocDoc. PocDoc support the show, and among other things, PocDoc is busy revolutionizing the world of point of care testing and making it as easy as possible to get a healthy heart check either in a pharmacy or NHS or at home. So if you would like to find out more information, please head to PocDoc.co or get in touch across any of the platforms. Thank you to everyone listening live on the incredible platform that is UK Health Radio, run by the ever effervescent Johan and his team. I almost forgot his name then, which is embarrassing because he's running the sound on the show this week. So Johan, thank you so much for the opportunity, and thank you to everyone listening live. Thank you also to everyone who's listening to this after the fact, and whether that's on YouTube or on any of the podcast channels. We got some great news this week, really exciting news. The Health Tech Hour is in the top 100 health and medicine podcasts for the UK, which has been amazing. We've been going, you know, just under 2 years. And obviously, this isn't my only gig. So it's a real testament to the guests, the producers, and also to UK Health Radio as well for helping us build the following that we've built. So we're now broadcasting to over 50 countries every single month. Hello to everybody from Saudi Arabia to Vietnam to Colombia to the US, and, you know, lots more to come. And obviously, I mention this every time, but it's not just me on UK Health Radio. There are many, many other fantastic presenters, and you can get all of their shows on the UK Health Radio podcast channels. So check that out as well. Now, this week, we're taking a very different tack to anything that we've done on the show before. So we're going to analyze the personality makeup of a huge number of digital health founders and CEOs. I am actually included in this cohort, so I'm a little bit nervous about having my personality dissected live on air. But as long as I don't come out and the conclusion is like I'm a complete sociopath, I think we'll be okay. So joking around, or joking aside rather, today's guest is Ian Coyne, who is a partner at Coulter & Partners, which is one of the leading executive search firms in health and life sciences in the UK, who spearheaded the research. So this is a piece of research that they commissioned to try and understand what made particularly digital health CEOs and founders tick. We're going to go into all of the findings. You know, there might be tears, maybe from me, I don't know, but we'll go through it all. And Ian is actually, apart from being one of the nicest people in the industry, he's also one of the most connected. And his quarterly health tech breakfast clubs are the stuff of legend. So Ian, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, Steve. This is it's a very hot seat, so I'm very pleased to be here.
Good. It's great to have you on the show. So let's start with the why. Why did you commission this piece of research, and what was it and what was behind it? Because look, on a personal level, I love, as I'm sure many of the people that took part, I love a bit of introspection. I love learning a bit about myself. But it was quite, you know, it was a surprise to have the thing drop into the inbox saying, do you want to participate? So what's the backstory?
So I was hoping you wouldn't ask this question because I didn't really have one at the start of this because like all research, I wanted to, so I was curious and there is a bit more to it than that, but I think in sort of doing the job we do, so in executive search, you spend a lot of time talking to investors, executives, board members, CEOs. And in digital health, invariably the conversations are about doing stuff that's not been done before. So in your world, Steve, you know, kind of being able to transform clinical pathways through technology is a huge benefit to the patient, is a huge benefit to the health system. But it's also really hard. And I think people that choose to go into this, and I'll turn it back on you in a second. I was just interested as to why, because someone else you had in the seat, I think about a year ago, Hakim Yabi, said to me, we were at a conference last year in Rome, and he said, you know, there are easier ways of making money than being in health tech. I agree with that.
Hakim, always ready with the one-liner. I like
yes.
that. Yeah.
So it was that curiosity. So that, you know, if you think about most other industries, so if you're going to start like a Vinted or a Depop or a Monzo bank, I think the kind of the way you're going to do that and the steps you're going to take are pretty well defined. You know, if you're going to start a marketplace, you need to get customers on board, you need to kind of build a great product, you need to then kind of get a value proposition, etc. I think in health tech, that's you're never sure about that, because you've got all of these stakeholders you've got to manage around health systems and who's going to pay for it and what a pharma think of it and, you know, who holds the data. There's all these really complex challenges, but then innovative founders still go after it, even though, you know, the chance of failure, I think, compared to a lot of other industries is incredibly high. So I guess I just wanted to understand, are these kind of these people like you, Steve, different from the average person that sits in a more, you know, mundane or predictable C-suite role?
Right. And yeah, I mean, a lot of that was, hopefully we can kind of cheer things up a little bit about, you know, So the original kind of proposition was, is there something unique around individuals that seek to found or run early stage or reasonably early stage high growth healthcare businesses versus their peers in non-healthcare businesses?
Yes, and I think it also, the other thing we really want to understand is, how do you build teams? Because that's how you make great companies. You have, you know, CEOs and founders are such an important internal and external kind of spearhead of the business. But to be successful, you know, in all worlds, you've got to build teams around you. And so the key is, you know, how do you kind of complement the founder with skills and preferences? And that's one important thing before we kind of dissect the character profile. This is all about how people prefer to work. It's not about people's abilities, because, you know, founders have the ability to build teams. Otherwise, we wouldn't have great, you know, huge companies today. But it's about what their natural desire is when they kind of step into this world, or in any kind of innovative world. So I think if you can understand founders and CEOs in particular, and in our world, often we will start working with founders and CEOs as they think about building out their senior team. So, you know, they might need a first chief product officer or chief technology officer or a head of business development to help them kind of get into health systems or pharma companies or med tech companies, whatever the kind of route to market is. And having a bit of data around people, I think, is really powerful, even if that's, you know, you can kind of go into all sorts of depths of psychological profiling. But I think even just being able to understand work styles and preferences of how people like to work can really help a team go from being, you know, functional to being really high performing.
I think that's would chime with, I mean, my, you know, before I was founded PocDoc, I spent the majority, if not the vast majority of my career in and around VC tech and startups and things like that. So I can certainly relate when we were building ViaGoGo, where we went through phases of having phenomenal individuals involved in the business at all levels, and at stages where we really struggled in a number of really key roles, and it dramatically held us back. And that was a marketplace, that was consumer, that didn't have any of the issues associated with healthcare that make it potentially more challenging. So I can totally relate to that.
Good. Should we dive into a couple of the results?
Yeah, well, yeah, let's just, let's go easy with so we're gonna do this. I'd just like to emphasize this is generalized results, okay? This isn't just my
Exactly.
results. We're not
It
gonna
is. This is
like
not.
share all my dirty laundry over here, but
So I've got your report here, Steve. If you want to go, no, we will not. We'll not
yeah,
go.
exactly. No, I went through mine with your colleague. It was very informative. But just before we do, this isn't very common. This what impressed me about this, about what you did, was that you're actually trying to deliver something of value back to the industry, at all, but also, sorry, it delivers value at multiple levels. It has value to the individual, it has value to the individual's company, and it also has value to the industry as a whole. And it was actually something that I, was it just something that you did you have, and it seems to have gotten quite a lot of traction from what I can tell. And so was that kind of, did you realize it would go like that, or was that just, part of the happy coincidence?
Yeah, I think it because I wanted it to be open source from the start. So obviously not, everyone's data that's taken part is completely confidential. So the deal was always take part, you'll get a full feedback session from one of our leadership development specialists who can talk you through your profile.
Which was
And then
excellent, by the way. It was an excellent feedback session.
good, good. I'm glad. I'll pass that on.
Yeah.
They're a brilliant team. And so that was number one. It is, I think it's quite rare as a, particularly as an early stage CEO, to have that when it's not driven by your investors or, kind of the perhaps the chair. So that was hopefully a good thing. And that was the deal to say, look, if you do this, your data goes into this anonymized aggregated data set. And then we can use this as a group to kind of understand ourselves better. So we published, I think, in February when we hit the first 50, 50. We're hoping to get to about 100 people by the time we get to Health in Amsterdam in June, and then push on to about 200 by the end of the year. Because then I think we can start cutting the data by sort of CEOs versus founders. So those that have kind of gone from zero to one, and those that have perhaps come in later and started to run these businesses. But also looking at those that, by different funding routes. So do the kind of venture-backed CEOs look a bit different from the sort of bootstrapped versus the
Right.
people that went down different routes of partnerships and other things. So yeah, it was always and I think it also encourages people to participate because I think compared to any other industry, health is one of the most collaborative industries I've ever worked in, having been in sort of telco and
I
FM
think you have
before.
to. It's impossible not to. I mean, but
Yes.
every step of the industry requires you to integrate, collaborate. There isn't the ability to end to own things end to end like you might have in other industries. You by virtue of the fact that it's a clinically driven industry, you have to collaborate.
Yes, yeah, and the ecosystem is key because to your point, you'll work across NHS pharmacies, kind of the sort of the segmentation of the NHS even in the UK is huge, and then you look at companies trying to get to the US, and that's a whole different kind of ball game of, splitting payers and providers up, and the role
Yeah.
that big pharma takes there. So, yeah, and it was also to kind of see if there is any commonality in this group, and I think the good news is there is, and also that that point around building teams, speaking to sort of the next level down, so GMs and C-suite members, I think they really value being able to see the difference in work styles between them and their boss, so they can kind of those gut feel things you often know in C-suite happening around, perhaps sort of execution focus over ideas. There's things you probably saw this at Viago go through the different growth phases. At times you feel like the team's really performing, and at times you feel like actually, the cogs are spinning, but we're not making the traction. And I think a lot of that is down to things like communication style and, leadership style and kind of how well people can structure a
Yeah,
team rather than just lead a team.
I think people who haven't worked in early stage businesses, particularly I would argue ones that are venture backed, probably, because I think bootstrap businesses, you're right, are different. Maybe different in a really good way, actually, because they are building viable businesses that can grow. They're not reliant on cheap capital. That's a kind of a topic for another day. But I do think that those people that haven't worked in those businesses, they underestimate the ability of individuals, whether they're really good or really bad, to impact progress. And particularly, I think you find in healthcare, a lot of individuals move from large organizations, big pharma, big diagnostics providers, systems, so on, across into a smaller startup environment. And sometimes that transition can go really, really well, and sometimes it can go really, really badly. That is probably due to personality in part, or in large part.
And I think in venture, you're right. I think in venture versus bootstrapping, you've got like the clock is ticking. So whenever I see an announcement of a fundraise, it's always a positive thing. You know, the innovation in health at the moment, despite, you know, probably not a fantastic year of funding last year, is still incredible. When you look at the sort of the data around genomics and genetics and the capability of that and the actual ability to transform the health system. I know there's sort of huge funding challenges around that. That innovation is incredible. But when you put the sort of clock of venture capital next to that, I think a lot of things get amplified. So to your point, the sort of speed you've got to deliver at, the kind of knowing that in 18 months time, you know, you need to be kind of either at point B, or at least really close to point B, to then get some more cash to carry on, you know, and does that kind of ramp up? I think it's a real, that can just amplify personality profile in a way that in a, you know, a more steady business, you don't see as much.
And what was, I don't disagree with you at all. Why does this study and the outcomes, do you think, matter? Why does it matter to individuals? Why does it matter to companies? Why does it matter to the industry? And I guess, why does it matter to you and Coulter and Partners?
So I think I'll go in reverse order. I think wherever we can reduce the risk of hiring, you know, the wrong person, that's a good thing, because to your point, you can interview, you can reference, you can meet people, you know, four or five times through an interview process, and still they don't work out. And, you know, that's and I'm sure everyone goes to those processes completely open and completely transparent and trying to make it work, and it doesn't. So I think the most basic level, it's another level of data for us to say, okay, if you're going to, and we've just finished off a really large CTO search for a drug discovery company. And we use this for the finalist candidates. And the CEO said, look, it's incredibly useful to sort of see my own results and see the CTO's results. So I kind of know what I'm getting and where we're going to be similar and where we're going to be different.
Yeah.
And it was actually really additive to say, look, I know I'm a detailed person. I know I'm, you know, focused on execution, and they're going to be a bit more challenging with me about innovation and driving new ideas through. Mm. It's probably an oversimplification, but at least, you know, okay, so when you get together, they're going to be the areas where perhaps there's a slight degree of uncomfortableness, where you're, you know, you've had a way of working for a long time, and then you're bringing in someone else that's quite new and different. Being able to kind of know that and quantify that in data. I think also when it's data, it's less about the individual, because you're kind of saying, look, we're looking at two sets of data here, not you being kind of slightly on the crazy scale when it comes to innovation and me being all trying to shut down your ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the lowest end. But then I think for the industry, everyone I've shown this to, so when I speak to investors, a lot of them kind of nod their heads and perhaps reflect a little bit and say, yeah, this is kind of what we look for. And they've sort of said, you know, maybe we need to think a bit careful about what we look for in our CEOs and founders.
In what sense? Like, as in, what might they adjust, do you think?
So I think we'll come on.
We'll get into the findings
after the break. But I think the innovation is, you know, any CEO and founder, I think, will have a high innovation streak. So that's probably no surprise in the results. But I think it's the point around taking risks and how you think about taking risks, because any innovation is a risk. Otherwise, it's not an innovation, right? You're just taking a product and moving it kind of one degree to the left. But if you're going to say, look, we're going to, you know, not have an old-fashioned blood drop test that you use a piece of cardboard for, we're going to use a smartphone, that's a big step. And so I think they want that risk, but I think they want to be careful about how much risk.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. And, okay, was there something else that did we get through? So what was this matters for the individuals, I assume, because it's good information that they should understand how they're going to be. what they're going to be like, how they work to interact with other people?
And I think from an industry perspective, I think it's just acknowledging that, we've called the report necessarily different, which is say, actually, you know, in a regulated environment, you've got to be happy to break some rules. So obviously not, you know, not sort of ones that get you into medical trouble or risk patients. But if you go into this environment without thinking that way, you're probably not going to come up with an innovative product that's really going to change patients' lives.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's more around, I think, unless you're willing to, the way I like to put it is that if I'd have really known how hard it was going to be, really in detail, I probably wouldn't, you know, that I wouldn't have necessarily, I don't think I would have, could have gotten the team together, if that makes sense, to and gotten the mission together. I think there's a value in naivety sometimes where, you know, you have this big vision and you're working towards it, and actually some level of comfort with the unknown and with taking a risk and the possibility of failure is obviously something you have to accept far more if you're in a kind of research and development heavy industry, because a lot of research just fails. A lot of stuff goes wrong. You know, there's that. Have you seen the amazing video about Musk and SpaceX? There's like a video meme that did the round of like all of the missiles that crashed. It was like one by one by one, and they got gradually like 1 inch higher, 1 inch higher, 1 inch higher, and they kept exploding or falling over. And then gradually one gets up to 100 meters, explodes, and then, you know, and it's all set to the tune of Gangster's Paradise. It's pretty funny. But it's a pretty informative video, right, around the development process when you're doing something new. A lot of stuff breaks before you get it right.
Yeah, the risk of failure is high.
Yeah, massive. And I think that plays back into how the investors have to look at it, how employees have to look at it, how the industry looks at it. It kind of all has to circle around. So to your point around the title of the study being necessarily different, then yeah, I would agree that this industry has to be necessarily different, and maybe the people in it are. So on that note, we're going to go for our first commercial break. And then after the break, we're going to dig into the results of the survey with Ian Coyne. Ian Coyne, my guest today, partner from Coulter & Partners, who have just published world first study, I believe, into the personality traits of digital health CEOs in the UK. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, your host, Steve Roost, host of the Health Tech Hour and CEO of PocDoc, a UK-based health tech business, who also support the show. Ian, welcome back. Ian Coyne, partner at Coulter & Partners. And let's dive straight in to the results of the necessarily different research study. So, Ian, over to you. Take it away.
So I'll just cover methodology first. So we've managed to get 50 CEOs and founders to complete a work styles and personality profile. And the reason we kind of chose those two things is, you know, personality profile is how you think and behave. And then the work styles is then how that interacts with the people around you. So they're the two things we looked at. And then once we had that data, we've benchmarked it against SavileWave, which is the platform we use. They have a C-suite benchmark. So they said, look, you've got a cohort now, 50. If we put them against that benchmark, do they score under or over? So rather than just saying, oh, you know, you scored, you know, highly on new products and services, because that might be common in C-suite people, we've got a really nice differences data set.
I think that's a really key thing to pick up on, which is you've compared the individuals in this digital health cohort against other individuals outside of digital health to see if there's something specific.
Yes.
Something going wrong in our brains that means we're so passionate about this area. Some fault, some underlying genetic abnormality that means we do this every day.
Yes, and there is. The good news is there is. That's always the thing. There's nothing worse than doing a bit of research and finding out there's nothing there. So no, there's And the report has all the data in, but I think there's kind of four key findings that go nicely together to kind of build this necessarily different profile. And the first one is unsurprisingly, if you look at kind of the top scores versus the C-suite, they're the kind of three big innovation scores. So building new products, changing organizations, and creating new markets. So they are, I think, in the 90th and 95th percentile, or you are in the 90th and 95th percentile when it comes to innovation, which makes sense because early stage companies, you are really, you're trying to either create a market, change a process, introduce something that's new. I guess the reason that sort of was slightly surprising is because I think the health system, if you kind of put in its broader sense of you know, in our world, NHS, pharma, medtech, investors, they're not geared up for innovation. I think that's kind of fair. And that's not, I'm never critical of the NHS. It's not, you know, an amazing service to have. But I think everyone who tries to drive innovation through it knows it's not particularly geared up, and some of the stakeholders are not all aligned behind you know, the need for innovation. So I think that's kind of what's great about that piece of data is it means that the data is probably right. When you find unsurprising data, I always think good. You know, you kind of got your first set. So that's kind of finding number one. You know, kind of innovation is the natural preference for this cohort.
That's good. Yeah, I think that's a good thing because otherwise we'd be really struggling running innovative companies. Yeah, I'm not so surprised about that one, but I am. The point that you make around actually we're innovators or trying to innovate in a system which doesn't necessarily encourage free form innovation is a really interesting, it's an interesting angle, actually.
Yeah, and I always think about it like a little bit like if you ever kind of take your kids bowling, you know, you have the bumpers that go up if you're terrible at bowling, or like
yes, I do.
So, like, I always think of kind of innovation. You know, it's a little bit like that. You've kind of got these bumpers everywhere in healthcare, which is, you know, you have a brilliant product, and it's going to change the lives of people with, you know, chronic respiratory conditions, but there's no funding. So it's like, okay, how do we get that? Because people can't necessarily always pay for this privately. So yeah, I think it's kind of, you're innovating in a world where you know there's a lot of kind of bumpers set aside.
I wonder whether that just sort of makes us very kind of stubborn and pigheaded, which is like, we'll pursue innovation because we believe it's the right thing to do. Even if the system at that point doesn't necessarily value it, we just believe at some point that it will do.
Which is finding two, which is like,
yes. I didn't, that wasn't a setup, I assure you.
So I think the second thing, and you know, when I think about data, looking at individual data points is interesting, but when you put the data points together, I think it becomes a sort of more interesting picture. And if you look at what's called the leadership risks of this group, which is where you typically spike together, there's a combination of three risks, which I think speak to that point, Steve, which is these leaders tend to be highly autonomous. So again, I wouldn't say that's surprising. It's not uncommon for us to look for autonomous leaders when we're doing our work. The second thing they are as well is daring. So that point around, actually, I think there's kind of innovation and then there's daring, which is saying innovation, you can kind of see the path to, and there's probably a degree of risk, but daring is to say, you know, how do we do something that's actually quite radically different? So you've got autonomy, you've got daring. And the bit where I think it gets interesting is there's also a high degree of being unpredictable. So, and remember, this is a kind of an and equation. So it's autonomous, yeah, daring, and unpredictable, which kind of goes back to the point.
Sounds like quite a mix.
Well, exactly, which goes back to my point before the break around building teams, because actually, you know, it's not, I don't think that is an unusual entrepreneurial profile, because, you know, it's what we kind of call a follow me fast profile. So look, they're very, if you kind of dig beneath the data, these people are great communicators. They are great storytellers. They can build a narrative. What they sometimes struggle to do is, if you think about the sort of the path they leave behind them, is not always looking back and checking everyone's, you know, if you can imagine you're cutting through the jungle, is everyone still there? Yeah. Are they like the other side of the stream or falling off the cliff as you've gone along?
Yeah, they've gone left at the fork, and then, you know, someone else has gone right.
Yes, yeah. Or don't have the equipment to follow you. You kind of, you know, you've got all of the kind of machetes and they're not able to follow. So no, I think you've kind of got, you know, high innovation and then this kind of interesting combination. And again, remember the I'm always careful not to be critical of CEOs and founders. These are preferences. These are how they like to work. That's not to say they can't work in another fashion, but again, going back to that point around pressure and kind of timing, you know, it's a kind of well documented fact that under pressure you have the extremes of personality profile coming out. So that's kind of, I think, finding two is it's an interesting risk combination of how these people are naturally. Again, they are tend to be very smart people who can adapt and learn. But again, I think it makes for an interesting leadership team dynamic.
Yeah, I would agree with all of those things. And I think it's probably a lot of that stuff, like you say, is probably universal across founders, entrepreneurs, you know. But some of that stuff around the unpredictable nature of it, or even being comfortable with. Whereas if you start a marketplace, just to go back, if you have a product that people want, then it's a lot more predictable about whether you'll be successful or not. It all comes down to numerical. Can I acquire customers at a cost that leaves me room for profit, for example? It's less around, well, how do I fit together all of the regulatory calculus with my R&D timeline and with my funding timeline and all of these different interlocking pieces that have to kind of fall into play, where, you know, at any moment something terrible could happen in your latest set of results that completely destroys everything that you've previously built. And a lot of that's outside of your control. Whereas I think in some other businesses, the success or failure is with much far, far more sequential and linear and within the control of the founding team or the team. But I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's where the unpredictability point comes from. Because if you, I remember speaking to a lot of med techs probably at the peak of COVID, and they were saying, look, one of the biggest challenges they have, and I don't know if you're affected by this, is when you go for European approval, you set timelines for your device to be approved. And a lot of the European startups are telling us, look, the FDA, whilst being really expensive, is predictable. You have kind of service levels in terms of when you can submit, what you need to submit, and how long that will take to get an approval or, you know, feedback as to why your device might not be approved. A lot of people said, look, the European approval mechanism is basically ground to a halt. And so you're then in a business where, to your point, Steve, you're growing a marketplace and you're just trying to, you know, you ramp up your customer acquisition. It's kind of in your control. You know, you spend more money on marketing and customer acquisition, and hopefully you get better lifetime value. If you had this kind of weird intermediary that said, look, you know, the European advertising agency might not approve your spend on Google AdWords for 4.5 months, you're kind of in limbo. So I think
I mean, right now, if you look at it right now, I mean, I've been hearing of CE marking delays of up to 2 years. Like, okay, so what, I mean,
what do I do with my product?
how do you run that company? I don't know how you do that. I mean, I know there are ways and means around it, but that's, I mean, you've got a fund, that's a pretty big valley of death to fund if that's the situation.
Yes, yeah. And that's often, I think, where organizations pivot into, you know, perhaps things like supporting clinical trials rather than trying to be supporting the NHS, because there's a shorter route to market in a lot of those instances.
Yeah, I think the NHS working in the UK, it's extremely hard to escape the gravity well of the NHS if you're a healthcare business. And it's a real double-edged sword because you want to work for, but a lot of the reason I include myself in this, I would say most healthcare founders, CEOs that I meet got into it because they want to help the NHS, you know, and they believe passionately that what we do, what they do, can help. But it can take a really long time, and that forces you to then look into other business models, which actually then may make it harder to work with the NHS because the NHS then may take a view about what you've gone on and done while you were waiting for them to do what you were waiting for them to do. So it does become quite hard actually to deal with that and to try and put it all together.
Yeah. And going back to your point at the start, that the reason we host the breakfast is actually just to build that ecosystem. So,
Yeah.
what starts as a kind of CEO and founder network, actually now we try and bring big pharma, medtech, NHS, the investors, some of the accelerators and incubators as well. So that sort of ecosystem building is really key.
Agreed. What so what's next? What's the next one?
So, unsurprisingly, they are not great at building teams. So the C-suite average comes out about 6 out of 10. The this T this group come out about 3.9. So again, naturally, their approach is again, it goes back to that kind of follow me fast approach. So if you again generalizing 50 people into one, if you think about their management style, it's going to be very much driven through kind of clear direction, tick in that box, clear communication, tick in that box. A bit about the how you get there, I think, is where it's not always natural for then these leaders to go down that level and say, great, as chief commercial officer or as CTO or as chief business officer, what I really need from you are these kind of four key deliverables this quarter. That sort of level of granularity is not always there. It's not, it's something to be learned. It's something that this group, is absolutely intellectually capable of picking up. However, going back to that default, the sort of it is a trailblazing, with kind of fire following them approach.
Okay.
Without necessarily but sort of firefighting behind.
So on this one, I want to pick this up a little bit because I suspect, as it did for me, for many people that read this idea that we are in this cohort not natural team builders, I think probably came as a slight surprise, obviously. And I can't remember exactly where I came out, but I think this trend was relatively universal. And so I just kind of want to dig into it because in order to run a business, you have to build a team. In order to grow a business, you have to build a team. You have to keep it together. You have to keep people motivated. But that's not necessarily exactly what we're talking about here, is it? It's sort of is subtly different, is it, or is it the same thing?
It is. No, I think it comes down to being highly structured about how you think about team. Because again, it's the if you look at the other areas in that kind of cluster, you've got communication. Again, they score well above the C-suite, and you've got what's called organizational commitment, which is enabling of people. So if you think about that kind of, let's say 1990 Silicon Valley leadership model of, get great people. Enable them and they'll make it happen. Slightly different in healthcare, I think, because there are more, bumpers. But I think it is that very structured thinking. And bear in mind, I think a lot of, I think Steve, you're probably an outlier. A lot of these founders are PhDs, doctors, kind of very scientific thinkers that think about product innovation research in a certain way, but don't necessarily think about team building in such a, methodical and perhaps academic way.
I could see that. Yeah, I could see that. These guys have brought down the average.
Those damn doctors.
Yeah, gosh dear. No, I could see that because I think, and I've done quite a bit of work with technical founders, and they've got a huge number of strengths, whereas but that background doesn't necessarily lend itself. It doesn't, it's not an immediate overlap with how to grow a company, I don't think. But if they can combine it, then they become amazingly powerful individuals, I think, because they have such a strong technical foundation that if they can combine some of the other bits to their sort of put that into their kind of feathers in their cap, so to speak, they become unbelievably powerful CEOs and leaders. So let's do the last one, and then we can do the final break. And then we can come back and kind of keep talking about various different things. So I'm interested in kind of what happens after this, both on a personal level, but also, on a kind of macro level. But what's the fourth and final kind of key learning here?
So the lowest score, so I think on the 75th percentile for this group is around what's called managed risk. So they this group are actually very, very open to let's say aggressive is the wrong word, creatively managing risk, let's call it. So if you just go a level below that measure, in managed risks, you've got things like adherence to process and policies, building out standard operating procedures. And so I think what you've got, and again, this is the bit where kind of it's the lowest scoring in a massively regulated environment. This is the bit where I think this is the bit that's necessary. I think versus, you know, fintech and marketplaces and consumer tech, I think you've got to go into this world thinking, I'm going to bend some of these rules and see how we go. Because, you know, I don't know, looking at kind of when you founded PocDoc, Steve, I don't know if even software as a medical device was a thing, right? Whether you can get software approved as a medical device, that's something that was relatively new. And I think a lot of companies that went through it early were kind of writing the playbook alongside a lot of the regulators. So if you're, you know, you're prepared to do that and say, look, I'm going to create something that I know is doesn't have a way of being approved, but I'm going to work with these perhaps slightly traditional risk-averse regulators to make it approved, that's a really big risk to invent something you are pretty sure right now is not something that would be allowed to go forward as a medical device.
Yeah, or like just be willing to throw everything in the belief that it's ultimately the right solution and the regulatory framework will catch up. I think it kind of also brings up this really interesting idea. And I'm obviously the stuff around Babylon, the kind of implosion there and other things that have happened around the kind of regulatory piece with AI particularly, and how far ahead generative AI is ahead of the regulatory structure, which, you know, I think is going to become a major issue ultimately for the industry at some point, if it isn't already. And the way that the regulatory frameworks, guidance, certification works, I cannot see how that generative AI is adopted at this point in time. And so it creates the situation where the founders of those companies either crack on anyway, or they immediately stop, which neither of which is a great option. I don't have a solution for it. Well, I've got some ideas, but now's not the time. But, you know, I don't know if that kind of plays into what you're talking about a little bit.
Yeah, and I think, look, we need to give ourselves a medal for going 45 minutes on a podcast without mentioning generative AI.
Yeah, I know. It must be a record.
I think it does. And, you know, I also have some views on generative AI. I think it's a great technology, but we'll probably, you know, go into the AI technology playbook like most other things. I think in given it was kind of the lowest score across this cohort, I think it is one thing that is a standout. And, you know, as we build the data set up to 100 and 200, hopefully this will be validated as well as going into a highly, highly regulated. And I think it's probably the same if you wound back the clock 10 years in fintech and said, you know, can you create a new bank that, you know, hasn't been created before and do it all online and not have branches? I think most people would have thought, you know, you're absolutely crazy to do that. How do you pay in checks and cash and all these things that people thought were, you know, core to the economy. I think kind of, you know, just so if you put all that together, you've got, you know, deep innovation, a kind of autonomous but perhaps quite chaotic profile. And again, remember, we're talking about one person in perhaps a team of, you know, 10, 30, 50, however big the company is. High degree of innovation, high degree of autonomy, and slightly chaotic cloud around them. It's not a natural disposition for them to build teams. But I think in this industry, they are prepared to take risks that means they can be successful. And I think actually they need to take those risks in order to be successful. Otherwise, you'll end up in a, you know, with a product that is not differentiated enough and not worth a health system or a pharma company or a regulator saying, we're going to make the investment to.
Well, even if you get, I mean, even if you get to that point, I mean, I know the regulatory side of things can be quite daunting. I think one of the things that we did very early on was, well, this was the first bit of money that we actually spent at the company, was installing our own regulatory system, regulatory framework, getting our ISO 13485 certificate. Shout out to all of you QMS nerds listening. That was the first thing that we did, and it was hugely daunting when you started a company and you want to go and talk about product development and all the exciting business development and commercial and all these other different things. And actually you're kind of sitting there having to kind of deal with this regulatory framework and really try and get your head around all of these different components that fit into a quality management system. But actually it stood us in a hugely good stead, actually. And I feel like the longer that you leave that, and the further it goes without you engaging with it, the harder it ultimately becomes when you do. But if you embed it as a strength in the business, then you start to learn, if you start to learn the intentions of the regulations and the regulators, and you, they're humans, and the regulations were drafted by humans, and they have a purpose and a spirit, and you can start to work with them and understand how to incorporate it into your business to deliver what you need to deliver. On the face of it, it could be very daunting and appear like it's black and white. Rarely, although in some instances, but rarely is it completely black or white in some of these instances. A lot of it is really around, particularly within a quality management system, it's on you as a manufacturer to set up your standards and demonstrate you stick to your standards. So a lot of it really boils down to, again, like, how do you manage risk within your business and being comfortable having those discussions, those debates, turning the problem around, trying different things, which I can well believe isn't a common trait to have.
Yeah. And I think you just articulated that last point there, Steve, which is, you know, there's a whole set of guidelines out there you need to follow as a medical device. And you've said, look, I'm going to set my bar here, wherever that, you know, not too far below, but saying, look, these are our quality levels. And that's a risk, but you basically said, look, I'm prepared to take it, and also prepared to take the flak if it's, you know, too low or too high.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to go to the last break now. That was good discussion. And now we don't have that much time left in the show. So we're going to do the last commercial break and then come back for the last little bit with Ian Coyne, partner at Coulter & Partners, who have just published a groundbreaking piece of research into the personality types of digital health CEOs versus CEOs in the wider world. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, your host, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Ian Coyne, partner at Coulter & Partners. So Ian, what is next with this research? What's going to happen next? Where does it go? What are you excited about?
So just one open offer. So like you have, Steve, any health tech CEO or founder listening now, would love to have them in the program. So just reach out. You can find me on LinkedIn primarily. So the deal is, as you did, the CEO and founders can have a full development session with one of our leadership development specialists. In return, that data set goes, the anonymous aggregated data goes into our data set. So that's just a shout out. So please do reach out. I said, I think everyone I've spoken to said it's valuable and really interesting.
Yeah, really exciting. I would emphasize to anyone who wants to do it, then they should reach out either to me or to Ian, and we can sort that out. We'll also, when we promote the show, Ian, we'll put it into the post. So see if we can get you some more people.
Thank you. So I think what's next is, so every time we get to 50 people, we're going to republish. And I think what we'll try and do is, at the moment, it's a PDF that's available on our website. We would like to get it onto a bit more of a product platform so people can kind of interrogate the data again, as we split it between, founders. I think one thing we touched on just before the break around founders, I think a lot of the incubators and accelerators that I work with insist on co-founders. And I think that's because they often want to kind of bring not just, a single person as the leader of the business, but try and bring a nice blend. And often those co-founders, they try and find, if it's in a sort of medical context, a CMO type and a CTO type to come together and bring real complementary skills.
I think that also makes sense. They just need to kind of not have all their eggs in one basket a little bit. And single founder businesses are unique in the way that they operate. And, you don't have quite the same checks and balances. And, whether that's on a personality level or a work level, it actually helps to have those in place, I believe. It's a bit like, why do you have a board? Well, you have a board to provide a plurality of opinions and approaches and advice, guidance, similar thing.
Yeah. I think I'd love to finish on a really, really positive note. So I'm conscious we've talked how hard this stuff is. But I think there's massive, massive glimmers of hope. And actually, I'd like to go back to 2016. Steve, we've worked out you're not very good at bowling. Did you ever play Pokemon Go?
I did, yeah, I did play Pokemon Go. I did. Not as quite as avidly as some of my friends. My friend Andy used to love it, but I know what you mean. And it was an amazing product. Brilliant
Yes, yeah.
product.
And there's some great health research been done around Pokemon Go. So I think at its peak, Pokemon Go got about 28 million daily active users, which is huge for, I think, the
Wild.
biggest app of the year. And they looked at it, so they looked at the US market and said, what impact did Pokemon Go have on people's health? And they said, look, they reckoned it added about 144 million steps to the activity of US people in 2016.
I love that. That's so good. Well, I'm not quite sure exactly what that says, but it's a great stat.
Yes, but if you go below that and say, okay, it actually reduced sedentary behavior of users by 30 minutes per day. So if you think
That's
about all the
insane.
kind of pushes in the UK or health systems done around activity, like this is possible. Like changing health is massively possible. Changing health through technology is massively possible. So it increased exercise by 26% for the average players. And then some of the psychological benefits were it re reduced psychological distress, it improved connectivity, as in personal connectivity of players, but also improved cognitive ability in the teenagers that used it. So if you think about kind of all these health companies, we've got this kind of safety, it's a safety net absolutely, which is prescribing and medical interventions being primarily done via doctors and professionals. But if you kind of blend that world of the kind of consumer behavior and tech, I think there's a huge opportunity for tech to be part of improving overall health. Because if you think about the rise of GLP-1s and Ozempic, it's
Yeah.
kind of to balance out the a lot of the you know that it's not political statements, but a lot of the challenges are that poor foods are cheaper than eating well. There's all these
Yeah.
kind of structural challenges in society, but you kind of go back to Pokemon Go and you can improve health through
Yeah.
technology. And
We just as a side, we know now that we Based on our preliminary data, we know that in the 2 weeks after you do a Pokedex test, just by having done the test, doesn't matter what your results are, whether they were good, bad, or indifferent, we can track that your activity goes up. So every time you engage with that moment, because it's immediate, because you can see it, because you get the advice and it's associated with the test, you're prompted, and actually that has a downstream impact on your activity that lasts for about 2 weeks. Similar kind of concept to the Pokemon Go.
yes, yeah. And I think I know Kate, who I think is on your one of your investors, and she said the same thing. People that engage in their health and their health data. So I know that it's not particularly accessible, but those people tend to be more healthy because they understand their health better. They can kind of understand the metrics around it. So that's kind of a sort of zero pharmaceutical intervention as well. So side effects, et cetera, don't even come into play. So that's why I think kind of the tech enablement of any form of care, and there's spectrums of complexity of that from just an app and around wellness and health all the way through to medical interventions that are backed up by digital therapeutics. It's the way the future's going to be in health.
I agree. On that note, I don't think there's any need for me to add anything on. I think we've that's a great way to end the show. So, Ian, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Been a pleasure.
Yeah, brilliant. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week. Have a great day.